problem with having a diagnosis like this is you don't know what your body's going to do. So you can't put a time on things. I mean, pretty early on, I was like, you know, I'm not going to be able to continue my degree in radiography because radiation does contribute to aplastic anemia, as well as flu jabs, actually. So I just got a flu jab at the hospital, and that's got links to it. But, you know, it's, I think my condition, the one I've got, is idiopathic, so they don't know what caused it. Can be genetic. So they did look into that, but no, it came back idiopathic. But at the time, you know, they were testing my brother for bone marrow. I mean, your siblings have the largest, you know, percent chance to be a match, and I think that's still only 25% as a full match. So, you know, your parents are out of the picture, and if your siblings aren't, then they go to look to an unrelated donor, which could be literally anywhere in the world. I mean, it goes off tissue type. So I've got a friend who's just had his transplant, and I think he only found about 3 matches in the whole world. Well, on the bone marrow register. This is why more people need to get on the bone marrow register. I mean, it's just, especially, I mean, I'll speak about this a bit later, but, you know, people of mixed race. I had a friend, and the bone marrow register, they've got so little people from different cultures on there and races that a lot of people die because they haven't got the tissue type for that. I mean, you can't match different races like that, I don't think. But yeah, so luckily, you know, I didn't need that. So we went on to ATG, which was what I thought I was going to have. I was just about to get my Hickman line in, and it was kind of a roller coaster ride because I'd really psyched myself up for it. You know, I was like, right, I'm going to be in for 6 weeks, and I'm going to have this treatment. You know, it's going to probably knock me for 6, and there's all sorts of complications with it. So I think at the time I got diagnosed, it was, I think, 70% chance to work, to restart your bone marrow. And since I've been diagnosed, I think it's gone down by like 20%. So it's obviously not working as well. This is why there's so much research into using donors with, you know, half your match. Because they do it off markers. So it should be 11 out of 11, I think. I think some places do it out of 10. But yeah, even 9 and 10 puts you at risk of all sorts of disease and stuff. Because if you think, you're getting someone else's bone marrow into you, and they look into tiny little things. It's not just your body picking up someone else's bone marrow. Say you've had chickenpox in the past, but you've had this, so, you know, your bone marrow knows how to fight chickenpox. Say this person whose bone marrow you're getting hasn't had chickenpox. In the 100 days, which is the time period where you do have your transplant, and you're in, you know, like a filtered room, very, very hygienic, there's a chance that you'll get chickenpox. And they're the sort of things that kill people in bone marrow transplants. I think the mortality rate is about 15% or something, which is quite high medically. It's quite a scary number. So, yeah, I'm kind of glad I didn't have that. And although at first it was weird to be disappointed to not be having treatment, you know, my consultant sat me down. They were like, you know, I think we're just going to hold off. Bearing in mind, I'd been so, so ready for it. And I was like, oh, I didn't know what to think about that. Because, you know, all I wanted to do was get back to uni. I'd already made the decision that I wouldn't be going back to radiography. And, you know, I thought, am I just going to be sitting at home for 3 years? Like, what sort of life is that? When all my friends are progressing, you know, my girlfriend's qualifying this year from uni. So I was like, you know, I need to, well, I hope. I was like, my body, come on, you can do it.
Yeah, and well, that's one of the reasons you've got involved with St. Michael's, isn't it? Just tell us, you know, how that all happened.
Yeah, of course. So I think I'd always been into healthcare. It's my passion. I absolutely love it. And I'm so lucky to have found, you know, a field which I'm so passionate about. I mean, when I work at the hospital now, and when I was on placement, you know, I didn't even look at the time. I just love being in the hospital. I'd absolutely adore it. Makes your day go quicker. I think I'd always really been a fan and enjoyed patient contact. It just makes your day. Even one little person can make your day. So I'd always had that craving. You know, I'd left uni, and I always, even when I was ill, just had the craving to want to, you know, help people and have that feeling back of just, you know, making a patient smile. And so as soon as my bloods were at a point, and I think it was just, I was kind of toying with it, because when I had my interviews for St. Michael's, I was on the borderline of being safe to, you know, going to patients' houses. But I really wanted to do it. And to be fair, I think I heard about St. Michael's anyway because of the Teenage Cancer Ward. I mean, hospices are spread throughout. And I'd known people that had gone into them. I didn't realise what an amazing place it was. I mean, down there at Crimple House, it's just you wouldn't want to be anywhere else if you're in palliative care, would you? It's incredible. So, yeah, I went down there, had my interviews. I mean, everyone's there for the right reasons. Everyone's just amazing. And you're all there, you know, for the same thing. So it's such a nice community to be part of. And especially with palliative care being a taboo subject anyway, I think bringing everyone together like that and speaking about it, it's just making it, you know, more out in the open. I mean, cancer in general now, because it's everywhere, I think there was a stat on the TV and it was 1 in 2 people in their life will experience cancer, which is just a ridiculous number. And, you know, I think it's increasing due to environmental factors and all sorts of things in the food, but you can delve into that as much as you want. So, yeah, then I started at the hospice. Obviously, you have your inductions and things like that. But then being matched with a patient isn't as easy as it sounds. They don't just put you with someone, you know, they take your characteristics down, what you're into and things like that. And then from there, people will come into the hospice. Because I think there's obviously a lot more volunteers than there is patients. So, yeah, I was waiting. I think I waited quite a while, like quite a few months to get matched with the patient that I'm with now. So in the meantime, while I was waiting, they tell you about the bereavement counselling course at the hospice. They do that as part of the induction. And I'd always, even on the ward, I'd see myself as a bit of, you know, I like speaking to people about it. And I've always been diplomatic in the way I like talking to people about their problems and things. So I thought, yeah, while I'm, you know, while I'm ill and still recovering and waiting for my patient, I can try this. Especially as I feel like I needed some brain stimulation. I mean, being at home, you know, you're not really putting your mind to something.
Yeah, interacting with people.
Yeah, not at all. And I mean, reading a book's fine, absorbing information, but if you're just sat on your own, it's not great. So, yeah, so I signed up for that, had my interview for that, because I think at this point I knew that I wanted to go into nursing. I mean, even before when I was doing radiography and on my placement, I had the feeling that I wanted to be a lot more involved with the patient's treatment. And I'd see the nurse and I was like, you know, this is a job that I can definitely see myself in. So at this point, I'd decided that I'm going to apply for nursing. And I thought, obviously, palliative care, bereavement's a huge part of everyday life these days. And with it being a taboo subject, I really thought that the skills that I learn here I can really put it to good use in my future career. So, yes, yeah, it's Just Be. That's the service. Amazing service. I mean, all the volunteers are there. I think it's 2.5 hours every Wednesday. I think they've cut it down now. We do that for about 10 weeks. And it's so nice because, you know, you're in your own little group. Everyone knows each other. You come in there voluntary. So, and this is the thing about voluntary work. No one's here because they're trying to get something out of it. This is your own time. So, yeah, every Wednesday I'd go for 2.5 hours and it'd take you through. The training's amazing. I mean, the two people that do it are just incredible. And it really opens your eyes to how tough bereavement is. And it's such a hard thing to sit there with someone's distress. I mean, all the volunteers are amazing, but with being young, it's a really hard thing to speak about this, like bereavement and cancer at this age. And I think this is one of the reasons why there's not many young volunteers. I mean, for a start, it's so hard for someone who isn't involved in healthcare to come and do something like volunteering at the hospice, because it's just not part of their life. They're not used to it, so they wouldn't go that way. And on the other hand, people who are doing health-related degrees, they don't have time. They don't have time to volunteer. So, you know, with me being off, you know, I could really, like, dive into it. And I'd always said, you know, my worst thing would be to have to stick in a job for the time where I go back to uni that I don't like doing. I didn't want to do that. You know, I know what I want to do. So, yeah, I was like, if I can invest all my time into volunteering when money will not be an issue, then I would. So that's where I applied at the hospice. But, yeah, ever since then, I did the bereavement counselling course, the bereavement support volunteer course. I didn't take it on as in get clients because, you know, I'd got my job now and I volunteer at the hospice, so I thought it'd be a bit much for me, especially as I still suffer from fatigue. But it was an incredible experience. I mean, I'll take everything I learned there. Definitely a very long way in the future. But then I got my patient about halfway through that. He's an amazing guy. He's 86, so there's obviously a big age gap there. I think at the start they were kind of not worried, but you know, they didn't know how it would pan out. I mean, I was expecting to get a young patient, and yeah, they give you a little package of information about him, and it's up to yourselves to go and arrange your meet 2 hours every week. And I can't explain how much of an amazing relationship it is. You don't know each other. You're going in with completely, you know, white canvases. And it's kind of, especially with my patient, every patient who's going through the hospice who you'd volunteer for has a terminal diagnosis. That's why they're there. And I think you're obviously, as a volunteer, you're going into it knowing that. I mean, inevitably, the end of your relationship is going to be death, isn't it? Which, you know, that's a big thing, because, you know, even though you don't know someone, you really become close to that person. I mean, there's some volunteers who've been with their patients for about 3 years now. And if you think 2.5 hours every week, that person is so involved in your life. You bring someone else into your life, and you've got such a special relationship that, you know, that's a really tough time when they do pass, when they do die. So, you know, you do go in it with that, but it's more about, I don't know, for me, you can make such a difference to someone's end-of-life care that will always stay with you. And obviously, it'll always stay with them. I mean, my patient, he's obviously quite isolated. I mean, he's elderly. Family live quite far away. So me and him being at day therapy at the hospice, you know, they're the only things where someone really comes in and speaks to him. And I think, obviously, after lost his wife of 65 years, which obviously devastating. I mean, I can't even imagine it at that age. I've been with my girlfriend for 4 years now, and it seems like, you know, forever. I can't imagine what 65 years is like after losing someone you love. So, yeah, it was a really big thing. And I think I've got such an amazing relationship with my grandparents anyway. And with him being 86, I see him as an elder. You should always respect your elders. I think that's a general rule. And yeah, it's young and old's just an amazing combination. You know, we bounce off each other. I sit there, and being a talkative person anyway, you know, I thought I'd go into it and I'd be the one talking all the time, and he'd just sit there and listen. It's completely the opposite way around. You know, I do talk, but I barely talk at all. He sits there and he talks about all sorts. I've learned so much from him. And to sit there and think this man has lived 4 times as long as me, it's just amazing. He's lived so much, he's got so much life experience. And even for me, like, I feel like I can understand myself. You and your mind can play awful tricks on you, you know. You can think such unreasonable things when things are so simple. You overthink a lot. And I think having me there each week to kind of, you know, discuss things which maybe he's thinking, yeah, it's great. It works amazingly. And I look forward to it every week going to see him.
So it's your highlight of your week, it's a highlight of his week.
Yeah, 100%. And it's just, you know, I think the thing is, there's no one else involved in your relationship. Like I say, it's just you two with that. I mean, it's very confidential. I mean, although you may sit with friends or relatives of theirs, you know, you do stick to whatever you talk about, you know, that's confidential between you two. So even from the volunteer's perspective, if you've had a bad day at work or you want to speak about your own personal problems yourself, you know, you can speak about that with them. And it's nice to have someone who isn't involved in your family life or work life that you can go and speak to. And I think that's one of the reasons why it works so well.
Fantastic. So you clearly would encourage anyone else then to do their bit if that's what they're missing, you know, to do something similar to you.
Yeah, 100%. I think at the commitment of 2 hours a week, I mean, if you really think about it, that's an easy commitment to make. I mean, I know people have busy work lives, and I'm not talking about everyone because people might not have time, but it's kind of like stepping out of maybe a busy time that you're having and having that time to relax. And I think a lot of people would get involved, but they don't know maybe how to go about it. I mean, I know there's a lot of advertising for St. Michael's, but even still, the amount of people I tell, you know, I volunteer at St. Michael's at Sinker Impel House down at Hornbeam, they don't even have a clue that it's down there. And I think that's one of the big things. It's really great to have, you know, the younger generation's perspective on things and to get involved with it all. But like I say, the majority of people do go to university, and it is a time restraint. But, you know, if we could really show how easy it is to volunteer and the sort of community that you have there, the type of volunteering that you do. I mean, I always say that it's hard for people who aren't involved in healthcare to go for this because it's such a taboo thing. I mean, even when I got diagnosed, some people, I could just visually tell that people were really awkward about asking how I am. They wouldn't know what to say to me, which in a way it kind of, although I completely understand that, openly speaking about things, especially bereavement, when I did the bereavement counselling, I mean, if someone's lost a relative, all they want someone to ask is, you know, what were they like, to speak about that person. I mean, I openly involve John's wife in our conversations. I mean, we still speak about her now like she's there and, you know, have a laugh with her. I'd always say, you know, what would Lillian think if you were doing that? And, you know, that's amazing. I can see him light up when you say that. Why should you forget about that person who's died, you know? You still need to involve them in your everyday life. And it's, again, a taboo thing. And it'll be the same for everyone who's not been involved with it. But this is why I think with cancer becoming more prevalent, hospices becoming a lot bigger. I mean, the demand for hospices now is huge. And that comes along with more people having cancer. I think in the future, it's going to bloom, really. Mm-hmm. I think now is kind of the period where, you know, even though it's been there for a long time, everywhere you look's cancer. On TV, there's always cancer adverts. It's always on leaflets, all over the news. You know, I think more people are, you know, we're accepting it as an everyday life sort of thing, and people are really going to start getting involved with it. And St. Michael's is just going to bloom, and so it should.
Yeah, and so anyone who, you know, feels sort of unwell like you did, you know your own body, but yeah, if someone's worried, what would you say to them?
So my advice would be, you know, if you do feel like there's something wrong, don't Google things, because you'll just, I mean, even if you Google headache symptoms, it'll probably come up as brain tumour or something like that. So it's an awful thing to do. But if you really feel like there's something wrong in your body, then obviously go to your GP about it. I think the problem with people's expectations of GPs now is that people expect to go and tell them their symptoms and GPs will miraculously tell them what's wrong. You know, we can't expect GPs to do that. I think you should just go there with, you know, clear changes in your symptoms. I mean, mine was obviously visual. And I think that was one of the big things, that I'd come up in huge bruises. And obviously from getting my blood done on the ward, I'd have a bruise like as big as my arm. And it'd go all the way through my tissue to the end. So that's why I'd got really bad joint pain at times. And, you know, if it persists and you do feel like you're getting ill, then, yeah, just go. And even if it's an embarrassing subject, go to the doctor about it. I mean, you shouldn't be embarrassed about something when it could be seriously life-threatening.